For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia.
Our clinics are much more nurse-led as opposed to everyone who comes in needs to see a GP. And trying to change that culture amongst our families and our people is really interesting, because most people go, you know, I'm sick, I need to see a doctor. Whereas, in fact, I'm sick, I need to see someone who can help me. It's not necessarily always the doctors.
What if getting care didn't have to mean seeing a doctor? Across Aotearoa, New Zealand, GP shortages are making it hard to get appointments, but Pacific communities are still finding creative ways to be cared for. At places like Etul Pacifica, walk-ins are welcome and consultations take the time to connect, while nurses, midwives and pharmacists handle repeat prescriptions and routine checks. And it's freeing up doctors' time and giving families the space they need to be heard. And with Pacific health professionals training in New Zealand and sharing what they learn back home, these approaches could ease pressure right across the Pacific. I caught up with Pacifica Medical Association CEO Debbie Sorensen, ONZM, to find out more.
Well, whakalo whalahia too. It is Niuean Language Week here in New Zealand, so it's only right that I finish the week by welcoming you and saying hello in Niuean. So I've been in this role for 18 years. I was previously a chief advisor to the Ministry of Health. I have been a general manager of Pacific Health Services and have worked in the region for my home country of Tonga. Have been incredibly blessed to be able to work back at home and to serve my community in Tonga as well as in New Zealand. I was awarded a Commander of the Royal Crown of Tonga by His Majesty. And most recently have been invested with an Officer of Merit for New Zealand in the King's and the New Year's honours. And so I feel that I've got, you know, quite a long-standing view of the way things change around the region, but also remember just where we've come from. Mm. You know, when I first started working, there were no Pacific health programs. And in fact, I can remember the day that we got our first bit of Pacific money, and it was $2 million. Mm. And so Bill English happened to be the Minister of Health at that time. And he said to Sir Colin Tokiatonga and myself, I'll give you the money if you manage the problems. And so that was the beginning of our kind of step into developing Pacific health services, which our communities had been crying out for many years. So the community continues to say this, that they want to be served by health professionals that look like them, that understand the context in which they live, are able to speak their languages and understand, you know, the unique challenges that we face as a community. And so none of that has changed. What has changed over 30 years is the breadth of services, both here in Aotearoa, but also in the region. Mm. And I think the biggest indication of that was over COVID, when many countries who work in a humanitarian kind of role in Pacific countries, you know, very really well-meaning, good individuals who provided services, thought, how will these countries survive with their borders down and how will they manage to look after their people? Mm. And indeed, the case was that they managed to look after their people exceptionally well. And I think it was a real kind of coming of age, because countries understood that they didn't actually need to rely on anyone else to deliver health services to their population. Mm. And so now we see, you know, many, many examples of excellence and practice. Just last week, we had the Uto Bula Bula trip, which is pediatric cardiac services. That team went out for its third mission in Fiji to operate on Pacific kids from Vanuatu, Samoa and Tonga and Fiji, who would otherwise have to come to New Zealand at a really large cost, be away from home for a very long time. And in this model, they're closer to home. They have their doctors from their home countries with them, who travel with them, and then they can go back and look after them. And so we're upskilling doctors from countries, you know, in all of these processes and in care. And also the families meet a cohort of other kids that are like them, and that's incredibly valuable for them to be able to talk to other parents in that way.
Whakalofala hiatu and maloelele, Debbie. I just want to start with some of these issues that you're seeing in Aotearoa. There's been surveys that have found 38% of GPs feeling high levels of burnout. Are those strains transferring through to our Pacific health providers in your clinics?
Yes, absolutely. You know, there's no question that all primary care services are under pressure. You know, it's highlighted by the winter demand when we're ordinarily busy and, you know, things are kind of a little bit stressful. But also I think that working conditions are really difficult. You know, there are many opportunities, and we have a pretty consistent flow of our GP fellows who will become fellows in New Zealand and then go to Australia, largely because salary and wages and living conditions are better than they are in New Zealand. But the pressure in services is certainly there. The question is, what do we do about that, and what does that mean? And for us, as a Pacific set of clinics, we're very lucky. You know, we have 98% of our clinical staff are Pacific. We have really supportive working conditions, you know, extended sick leave, lots of annual leave, lots of ability to work from home. If your child is sick or someone in your family is sick and you need to stay home, then people are paid for that. So the working conditions are very supportive in the background, and I think that that's really important. But also because we're a training service, you know, we have dedicated ourselves to train Pacific GPs over the last 5 to 10 years and put them through the fellowship program, then we expect that they will leave. You know, we don't expect that people will work for us and stay for the rest of their lives. You know, we'd expect that they would have 2 or 3 more jobs left in them. Mm. And so we are training for the sector, not just for the service. And as much as we would like to hold on to them, because it feels a little bit, I've got to say, you know, I'm really old, and so it feels a little bit like a group of my children working in the clinics, watching them progress and look at other opportunities and move is really important, and supporting them to do that so that they can feel that they can always come back. And so we have many examples of fellows who have gone away and done something else and then come back and are either doing locum work for us or have come back into positions having been away for a while. And, you know, that's a fantastic thing. We say to people, you're always welcome back home.
Mm. And I do remember the Utom Bula Bula initiative and the beautiful children that had, you know, complete heart reconstructive, you know, surgeries and have just gone on to live incredible lives and grow up completely free of issues. Yeah, that's definitely one of those things that you don't want to stop. And so does the work of the Pacifica Medical Association, you know, do these impacts around GP shortages affect the region when it comes to training and upskilling, but also the people who do need to come across to New Zealand or to Aotearoa?
Yeah, that's right. So the Pacifica Medical Association delivers the New Zealand Medical Treatment Scheme in 6 countries on behalf of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And we're at the end of our 2nd year of a 3-year program doing that. We had previously delivered that program for 15 years, so we've got quite a lot of experience. And it has 3 components to it. One is to move people to New Zealand, Australia or Fiji who might need clinical care and that they can't receive it in their countries. And all of the people that move are people who have conditions that will benefit from that. And so, you know, you'd be aware that a number of people would like to come to New Zealand, for example, but they might have metastatic cancer. And that's not a good thing for them to do. It's not good for them. It's not good for their families. And there's not a lot that can be done, and they're better off at home. And so, you know, making sure that the people who are moving are really going to benefit, you know, that their conditions are largely curative. Sometimes we take people who need some certainty, for example, around what's wrong with them, and they might go home, you know, with news that's less than what they had hoped for, but they have some certainty about their condition. So that group of people we're very happy to take, and part of the process is that the clinicians in country refer them to our medical team. And those clinicians are involved then in follow-up care and understanding what treatment the people have in New Zealand, and then what care they might need once they go back home. But also our clinicians in the countries develop strong relationships with clinicians here in New Zealand and Australia. And that's really important, where they can pick up the phone and talk to a surgeon or a paediatrician and say, look, I've got this case. Can I just talk to you about this? Or what do you think about this? And those relationships are just worth gold. You know, they're fantastic. Second part of the program is that we send medical teams, clinical teams, and Uto Bulabula is an example of that. But medical teams across the whole spectrum. So we send mental health teams, we send pediatric teams, we send, you know, gynecology teams, surgical teams, right across the region. And countries decide what teams they need. So we don't sit back comfortably in New Zealand and go, we think you should have this, this and this. Countries actually have a look at it and say, you know, we've got a waiting list for urology of 20 patients. We need a team. And so countries really drive that and have responsibility for that and are involved in every part of it, which is fantastic. The third part of the program is building capacity amongst our clinical staff. So that's working with predominantly doctors and nurses, but sometimes allied health people and technical staff, to actually build their skills so that they can deliver more services back in their countries. So that might involve a workshop. It might involve going to a meeting. It could involve, you know, doing some training on a longer term. And one of the other programs that is complementary is the Pacifica Medical Association offers scholarships for people in the region to actually go and do additional training where they wouldn't normally. So, for example, we offer two large scholarships a year where people can go to things like, you know, do the health services management program at Harvard. And, you know, being able to work at that level and experience that is fantastic. And it just gives people a different view once they go back home.
You're listening to Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia.
On Pacific Pulse today, our guest is Debbie Sorensen, ONZM, and she's the Chief Executive of the Pacifica Medical Association in Aotearoa, New Zealand. We've been talking a little bit about what has been reported as, you know, quite widespread doctor shortages and high demand for GPs, and especially how that might affect the region broadly. Debbie, when Pacific families see in the news that it's, you know, they're trying to get into GPs and booking appointments can be a little bit like missing out on concert tickets, you know, it's just you kind of blink and those appointments are gone. They'll maybe hold off or wait to see a doctor. So what is the message at the moment to these families?
We're very lucky. In our three clinics, we have two clinics in Auckland and one clinic in Christchurch in the South Island. We're very lucky because we will take walk-in patients, so enrolled patients can just turn up, first thing. Second thing, they can ring the clinic and talk to our schedulers who are able to triage them on the phone. And our schedulers are clinically trained. They're actually doctors who have been trained out of Fiji Medical School or UPNG and University of Papua New Guinea and have come to New Zealand and don't work as doctors but can work as schedulers. And so people have access to quite a high level of information and support where they can, the schedulers can help them with what they might need. We also are fully staffed with nurses, and we have nurse prescribers, nurse practitioners, and our nurses are just about to embark on a community nurse prescribing program over 18 months. And all 22 of our nurses in 18 months will be qualified. And that means that our clinics are much more nurse-led, as opposed to everyone who comes in needs to see a GP. Mm. And trying to change that culture amongst our families and our people is really interesting, because most people go, you know, I'm sick, I need to see a doctor. Yeah. Whereas, in fact, I'm sick, I need to see someone who can help me. It's not necessarily always a doctor. So, for example, if you're wanting a repeat prescription, you don't need to see a doctor. You know, in most cases, if you've been seen in the last 3 to 6 months, then the nurse prescriber can do that, or the pharmacists that work on site. And so they're much better placed. If you're a young woman and you're pregnant, you don't need to see a GP. You're not sick. You're having a baby. So indeed, the best person for you to see is the midwife in the clinic or a nursing lead who can talk to you and just make sure that you're monitored. And certainly if you have complex medical conditions, then, you know, seeing doctors is right. And so I think the message for us with our families is for people not to be frightened around the reporting that, you know, you can't see a GP, you can't get in, but to actually access healthcare early. Because if you wait, the chances are that your condition will progress, you will get very sick, and then you will need more advanced care, which could include going to hospital. And so in particular, over the winter, we've seen this with children who have had influenza or respiratory virus and get sick very quickly, you know, over the space of 12 hours, you know, your 5 or 6 year old could end up being a little bit unwell to actually needing to be in hospital. And so encouraging people, if they are worried, to always seek help. And there's many places. We have a service called Care HQ, which is an online consultation service. And so if you're unable to see your GP, you can use a number of other services. Again, for us, we're very lucky because we have an walk-in service. We have no co-payments for people who are enrolled. And, you know, sometimes that is a problem, because if you have to pay $100 to see your GP as a co-payment, it's a problem. You know, people don't have that money. They just don't have it. So they will wait till they get sicker and then turn up in the emergency department.
There's some really troubling practices there around people just needing to do what they need, but also maybe not realizing the amount of support that you've put on in light of these issues. You know, you've spent years advocating for Pacific-led health solutions, and those solutions were already there. And like we spoke about, it's more so the policy structures and the government and the will that has kind of waned and shifted. But, you know, in a time when this whole health system is under strain, what do you think makes this Pacific model of care so resilient?
I think part of it is that we are deeply grounded in our communities. And so, you know, we're not people who are sitting in our offices doing things to people. You know, these are our aunties and our nannas and our brothers and our sisters. And so the thing that is so satisfying, which is what our doctors and nurses talk to me about, is that the comfort that they can provide to people when they come into our services. You know, people walk through the door and we don't have that kind of, you know, cattle lineup in our clinics. It's more like going to the Cori Club. People come in their uncomfortable chairs. Someone will ask them if they like a cup of tea or coffee or water. There's fruit available. You know, their children are welcome. We have hosts who are there. And so these aren't people who call out someone's name and say, oh, you owe us $300. You know, and I've seen that in clinics, and I just think it's absolutely dreadful. You know, they're people that look after them. And so I think being deeply grounded in our communities makes a real difference, and it makes a difference to getting up and going to work every day, because we have a purpose. You know, our why is very clear. You know, it is joyful to be able to serve your community so well. It does mean that we do things differently and that we have longer appointment times, because, you know, you would get the fact that we can't say hello in 5 minutes. You know, by the time you catch up with, well, were you at church last week and did you hear about the latest funeral and so-and-so's had a baby? You know, that's 5 or 10 minutes gone. But it's a really important part of the consultation process, where people feel connected and feel that they are understood and that they are known. And so I think, you know, that's one of the things that makes us resilient. But also we are uncompromising in believing in our model of care, and we're uncompromising in the support that we get from our communities and the mandate that our communities have given us.
Mm. Well, I think it's lovely that the GPs or doctors, training doctors that are coming from the region are learning in an environment like this. Some of these lessons, like you spoke about how you're trying to bring nurses more into general practice, into ways to streamline doctors or clinics, sorry, is this something that the broader region can learn from? Maybe, you know, without people being so interested in becoming doctors, maybe nursing is more applicable, maybe more practical?
I think so. And I think one of the lessons that I think is learned is that the region is a little bit overwhelmed by consultants and people coming in to tell countries, you know, this is what you should do. Those consultants are not necessarily experienced in, you know, the leading models, for example, of primary care. And so sometimes you get that colonized kind of approach because that's what people are doing. And, you know, this flows into the way that hospitals and clinics are actually built in the region. Mm. You know, they're not taking the best practice that you see in New Zealand and Australia and learning those lessons. They're building colonial type hospitals, you know, where people are lined up with no privacy, those sorts of things. And so I think that it's really important that we have the ability to share these lessons with each other. And so, for example, the Pacifica Medical Association conference next year in August, where we celebrate 30 years of service, and our theme is the pathway to leadership is service, really enables us to get together with our colleagues and share these lessons, share these models, not just our models, but also the models from the region. And so, you know, there are some really innovative models going on in countries which, you know, have developed because they are resource poor. And so they've had to, you know, think about other ways of doing things. And so that kind of collection of being able to exchange ideas and lessons learned is really important.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Debbie, thank you so much for giving me 25 minutes of your afternoon. Was there anything on this topic that you wanted to add as a final message or anything that you think I might have missed?
I think that sometimes there is a notion that Pacific services or ethnic-based services are less than mainstream services. Mm. I think sometimes people hear that they might get, you know, that their doctor is not as good as any other doctor, that the services are not as good. And this is just absolutely not true, that our doctors are at the top of their game. They are leaders in their field. Our nurses are the same, and we're immensely proud of them. Mm. To have the community trust us with their care is really important. But also for us not to get too bogged down with the day-to-day issues, you know, that kind of come and go a little bit, and continue to keep our heads up. You know, I often talk to people about keep your chin up and look forward instead of thinking, oh, this is really terrible and we're never going to get through this, because the truth is we will get through this. Mm. There will be another cycle where this kind of right-wing difficult context should soften up somewhat. And the thing that will make a difference is our absolute unwavering belief in the right thing to do and in us continuing to have services that serve our communities in the way that our communities and families want. So being culturally anchored, being clinically expert, and being family-driven is really the things that are important to us.
You're listening to Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia.
A very big thank you to Debbie Sorensen, the CEO of the Pacifica Medical Association, for sharing her time and insights here on Pacific Pulse. If you missed any part of this conversation, you can listen back on the ABC Pacific website or wherever you stream your podcasts. This episode was produced on Yuggera and Turrbal Country.